In 1974, a man by the name of Alan Buckey sued the Medical College of the University of California in Davis for its failure to admit him to the freshman class at the medical school the previous year. Now, normally one does not think of suing a medical school for admission. There were 2,664 applicants for 100 places in that medical school class. But Mr. Buckey claimed that his application for admission had not been treated equally with those of some other students who were admitted. And he sued the university under the Equal Protections Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. In the subsequent trial, the medical school described its method of evaluating the many applications it received. It tended to quantify various categories in which each candidate was graded. And it admitted in open court that there were two instances each year in which a number of applicants were admitted whose grades were not simply the top grades on the list. Each year, the university said, a very small number of applicants were admitted for what were called family considerations. The University of California is a state support institution. It requires friends in the state legislature and presumably the sons of influential legislators and presidents of medical associations had a certain leg up. Beyond this, the university admitted that it had a two-tier admission system. 84 of the candidates, of the members of the freshman class, were admitted in a usual procedure. That is, their grades were quantified on the basis of their college records, the medical college aptitude and achievement tests, letters of recommendation, and the personal interview that was required. But 16 places in the class were reserved for those applicants who had checked a certain box on the application form, which read as follows. Applicants from economically and educationally disadvantaged backgrounds. Applicants from economically and educationally disadvantaged backgrounds are evaluated by a special committee of the admissions committee. If you wish your application to be considered by this group, check this space. Now, Mr. Buckey did not check this space. He was a 33-year-old college graduate, a graduate engineer, a veteran of Vietnam, who was gainfully employed, and he did not check the idea that his background was either economically or educationally disadvantaged. The medical school at Davis is a relatively new institution. It had been created just 6 years before by the California State Legislature. It had been brought into being at a time when universities were very conscious of the civil rights movement, and particularly conscious of the fact that there is a very small percentage of men in the medical field, of doctors, who come from groups other than the white middle and upper classes. There's a very small number of Mexican Americans, of American Indians, and of blacks in the medical profession. And it had obviously created this system, this two-tier system, as a contribution to the growing diversity of backgrounds that hopefully would be brought into the medical field. Now, Mr. Buckey claimed that this process, this two-tier process, violated his protections under the 14th Amendment in two instances. In the first instance, that even when a fifth set of grades were quantified, grades which were given to each applicant of this second level on the basis of what was called social criteria. Social criteria is apparently a euphemism for a judgment of capacity, of will, of ability, of determination, of potential, of how far a particularly disadvantaged candidate had come from his background to the moment he had applied to the medical school. It was a judgment made by those who evaluated him or her on the basis of her or his possible contributions to medicine, independent of the grades, the achievements that had been garnered up to that point. A recognition that if you are advantaged, you have advantages. And if you're disadvantaged, you are to a certain degree incapacitated and cannot compete equally. The first of Mr. Bakke's claims was that even when this fifth set of grades, this extra 100 points, was factored into the admissions files, a number of those, rather large number of those, were admitted as the 16 disadvantaged candidates, failed to have scores that were higher or equal to his own. And his second claim was that, in fact, this second tier of admission was not designed simply for the economically and educationally disadvantaged, but was a racial quota. In the 5 years in which this second system of admissions had been in existence, no white candidate who was educationally or economically disadvantaged had been admitted by this route. That is, that the second tier was reserved for certain designated minorities or races, and this denied him and others their rights under the Equal Protection Clause. The trial judge in California agreed. When the case was appealed to the California Supreme Court, 6 of the 7 judges of the court affirmed the lower court decision. And as you know, the case has now been accepted by the United States Supreme Court. Oral arguments were heard about 10 days ago. The court has now requested further oral arguments sometime in November. And the case has become one of the most celebrated in recent American judicial history. It's been talked about everywhere because it brings into sharp focus some of the most critical problems facing the United States. How can we force open the doors of opportunity to those whose background has been disadvantaged, who have not had an equal opportunity, and at the same time not trample on the Constitution and the guarantees of equal rights for each individual within the society? Now, as you know, in recent years, the federal government has more and more adopted a program which is generally called affirmative action. Affirmative action describes a process by which the Congress or agencies of the federal government decree that in order to receive certain funds for employment or public works or public housing or grants for research or teaching at the universities, the receiving institution or corporate body must agree that a certain percentage of the jobs which will be developed, of the buildings which will be built, of the research which will be done by, built by, given over to people who come from certain specified categories. These categories may be sexual, women, they may be racial, or they may define theoretically any group within the social order. And these, the purpose of this program, obviously, is to, in a sense, force feed, give a leg up to those who have been disadvantaged, who may not be able to complete equally at the initial stage. It's designed to bring the other America into American opportunity. And the numerical quotas that are established, the percentages which are established as goals or as quotas, are there because they provide numbers which can be actually examined. One can go into a program and see whether the corporation or the labor union or the community, in fact, cooperated with the purpose of the program or dug in its heels and failed to cooperate, because there are numbers that can be put down and looked at and judgments can be made. Affirmative action has spread broadly across the funding of local activities by the federal government. And it provides, obviously, a way of twisting the arm of recalcitrant groups within society who might not otherwise be moved to do things which the society generally feels ought to be done, to provide an opportunity to all Americans to take part in our prosperity and in the opportunity which is available. Now, the problem that many of those who are deeply concerned with the unemployment, with the disparity of opportunity which exists in America, the problem which many of them face is this, that there is a troubling inconsistency within the affirmative action program. And that is that it is designed not simply, that it, in design, it does not simply benefit those who are economically or educationally disadvantaged. But generally, the government has simply drawn categories: women, blacks, Mexican American, Native Americans, which is the euphemism for American Indians, or some other category, and said that so much of this particular project must go to these people. Now, the problem here is this, that there are among women, to a large degree, and to a certain degree among the blacks and the Mexican American and other groups, there are individuals who have had every advantage, who come from privileged backgrounds, who've had fine educations, who can compete with full equality in the marketplace for position. Yet because the government has established these categories, these people are given an advantage over others who may not fall into those categories, who have not had the opportunity that they have enjoyed. Now, the problem here is not only one of seeming equity, but it's one which goes to the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Those who affirm the urgency and the propriety of affirmative action programs argue, on the other hand, that without these labels, there would be no way of quantifying, of measuring compliance. And then, in point of fact, it's at this point, in this moment in time, important for large numbers of women, of blacks, of Mexican Americans, etc., to move into positions of authority and power. And it matters not whether some who have been advantaged from birth come to these positions, because they will, by being there, protect others who bear the label, who share the category, the identity which they come from. And tribunes of those who live in the ghetto, who suffer employment and educational disadvantage, who suffer from all the coldness and the disadvantages of American society, are impatient, desperately impatient, with what they see as legal quibbling with those who have up till now been colleagues in the civil rights movement, who are unwilling to go along with them this final step of the way. They see, they have claimed that many of those who have sent in amicus briefs to the court from traditional civil rights proponents are in fact latent racists, because they're unwilling to see the urgency now of pushing forward with the affirmative action program. It's a problem. It's a serious, difficult, sobering problem. How can we force America, an America which is still to a large degree racist, an America which is still to a large degree determined to maintain ancient privileges, an America which is to a certain degree clannish, how can we get America to become open and truly democratic and truly aware of the urgencies of bringing in large numbers of people who are now on the out looking in, who do not have the advantages that we do? How can we accomplish this and at the same time protect the people who would like to work and to get ahead, the Alan Bakkes of the world, who are seemingly discriminated against by the affirmative action programs which have been so far contemplated? Now, it is important, it seems to me, to recognize what is involved and what is not involved. What is not involved is the illegality by the University of California Medical School in Davis of establishing or setting aside 16 places in its admission, in its freshman class at the medical school, for the educationally or the economically disadvantaged. The trial judge in California said specifically, it is not unconstitutional to give extra consideration to those who have disadvantageous backgrounds, provided such benefits are applied equally to all who fall into that class. And the majority, the six of the seven of the justices of the California Supreme Court, agreed in that finding. What is at issue is the fact that the University of California did not open this category to all who were economically and educationally disadvantaged, and in fact used this category to provide opportunity for people who came from certain races and categories, classes in society, regardless of the requirement that it was open to all who could qualify. It is also not at issue that racial quotas can be legal. They are legal, as we have seen in many instances, when they are applied as designs or as penalties for institutions which have been found to have discriminated in the past, and where it is in the public interest to force these institutions to be open in the future. We have a very clear example of that in Cleveland. Judge Battisti and his master are to attempt imposing racial quotas on the faculty and on the supervisory personnel and on the student body of our Cleveland public school systems, because the Cleveland Board of Education was found in a long trial to have engaged in 20 or 30 years of active and passive discrimination against racial minorities in Cleveland. And the courts have ruled time and again that when a specific act of discrimination can be shown, then as a remedy for that particular act, it is not illegal or unconstitutional for the courts to require the establishment of racial quotas and to require the institution which has been adjudged guilty to live up to these racial quotas. But the case in Davis is not the same as the case in the Cleveland public school system. Davis had in fact not been adjudged guilty of past discrimination. It was a new school. It was a school which from the very beginning had obviously been eager to open its doors to those of the excluded groups. There is no finding in the court record of discrimination. And as a matter of fact, after the reverse decision, after the affirmation rather, by the majority of the California Supreme Court of the lower court decision, the Conference of Black Lawyers and Mexican-American Civil Rights Lawyers, which had been working with the University Board of Trustees in defending the case, appealed to the Board of Trustees not to take this case up to the United States Supreme Court. They did not want, at that point, this whole question of racial quotas and racial goals to be judged in a case in which there was no previous finding of discrimination. Because here the issue stood out in bold relief. Here the issue was whether an institution or the Congress, a legislator, had the right for reasons of its own to manipulate the social order by imposing certain programs which would grant advantages to individuals who belong to certain named categories, named by the university or legislator for their own reasons. In other words, whether we can use racial goals or racial quotas as a way of manipulating the society to ends which we feel to be desirable without a previous finding of discrimination in a specific instance on the part of a court. That's the issue. The issue is whether or not the American polity will more and more be governed by racial labels. And so much of the economic pie, so much of every federal program will be designed for those who come under specific categories designed by some federal administrator or by the Congress of the United States. Here, of course, the whole thrust of the affirmative action program runs up against the Equal Protection Clause. And in the brief which was submitted by the Justice Department after a great deal of pressure, as you know, both within and without the government, there was an interesting appendix which listed some 15 major federal programs where affirmative action was involved, programs in which presumably an adverse decision by the Supreme Court striking down the Davis program or affirming the lower court would in fact damage the ability of the federal government to move in directions which it and many in the society felt to be desirable. Typical of these programs is the recently passed Public Works Bill, which provides $4 billion of monies for construction in order to bring more people to work. Obviously, we want as much as possible to bring the unemployed, those who are discriminated against, to work. And one of the provisions of this bill requires that 10% of the funding in matters of construction for contractors, subcontractors, the purchasing of things from business people shall be given to those who qualify as being members of certain minorities, certain designated and stipulated minorities. Now, there is no exact finding of discrimination here on the part of any and all who will bid for these federal jobs. There is simply the desire of the federal government to open up to minority businesses, to open up to jobs to minority employment, a laudable undertaking, certainly, but one which can be challenged on the basis that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of our Constitution. Now, those who argue that it is necessary to have racial goals, racial quotas, affirmative action in its present form should be applied across the board to all federal programs, argue not only that there is terrible need, that there is economic and privilege disadvantage, that it's unequally distributed in our society, there's no question of that, that the blacks and the Mexican Americans, the Indians and others suffer far more discrimination, passive and active, latent and obvious, than most other groups do. But they argue also that it's important that this be done in order to make amends for past discrimination. As a theologian, it's interesting that at this point in our secular history, we've tended to adapt to politics an old Christian theological postulate, that of original sin. In Adam's fall, we sin at all. The idea that the father's iniquity somehow passes down through the generations to their sons and to their grandsons. That Alan Bakke, simply because he is white and male, must somehow be penalized because a generation ago, or two generations ago, or three generations ago, those who were white and male were in fact sexist and were in fact racist and in fact did discriminate against those of the minorities at that time. He is not being judged for any racist act or any sexist act. Others have been so adjudged, unquestionably. But it is the Alan Bakke who is, in a sense, made to pay the price for what has happened in the past. And this argument, which has a great deal of rhetorical popularity, we must make amends, we must give opportunity to those groups which have been disadvantaged up till now, has been one which has appealed to those who are heart and soul involved in the long, difficult, punishing struggle, political struggle to find opportunity. But it's one that needs to be more closely examined. What is it that describes the disadvantage? Who describes, defines the categories which are disadvantaged? There was, as you recall, about 3 years ago, the case of a young law student who had been refused admission at the University of Washington Law School, a man by the name of DeFunis. And this case was also brought up, and it was presumed that it would be the case on which the whole question of racial quotas and racial goals and affirmative action would be judged. The case was, however, mooted because the university admitted Mr. DeFunis, and the Supreme Court, on that narrow grounds, refused to consider the issues. But during the discussion of the DeFunis case, the Columbia University Law School Review published an interesting article by a man named Lawrence Levisky, in which he said in part, "The argument that a racial classification which discriminates against white people is not inherently suspect implies that the white majority is monolithic and so politically powerful as not to require the constitutional safeguards afforded minority racial groups. But the white majority is pluralistic, containing within itself a multitude of religious and ethnic minorities, Catholics, Jews, Italians, Irish, Poles, and many others who are vulnerable to prejudice and who to this day suffer the effects of past discrimination. Such groups have only recently begun to enjoy the benefits of a free society, and should not be exposed to new discriminatory bars, even if they are raised in the cause of compensation to certain racial minorities for past inequities. What he's saying here is that it's too easy to say that discrimination is limited, or has been limited in the past, to certain groups, and to declare these as necessary benefits of an anti-discrimination program. Whether, if we accept this argument, the argument that there ought to be inherited advantage to those who come out of discriminate against groups, then I'm afraid we're going to move towards a society where more and more legislative pressure is going to be exerted to define each group as a minority, each group as a group which ought to be advantaged by giving it a certain goal or quota of a federal program. And instead of having a society moving towards commonality, true community, we're going to have a society where certain kinds of arbitrary definitions describe the opportunity which is yours or mine or anyone else's within a particular program, educational or otherwise. The problem is real. And it's not easy to see how we are going to get at the root problems of economic and educational disadvantage without having definable categories, measuring sticks, ways of forcing recalcitrant communities and institutions to begin to be concerned and involved and active in this area. But if we do create these categories are ethnic or racial or religious, we're obviously introducing an element of division within the social order, which has not existed till now. We're also denying a basic precept of the Constitution, that is the Equal Protection Clause. And it was interesting to me that in his ruling, the trial judge in California in 1974 ended his ruling by quoting from the conclusion of Chief Justice Earl Warren's decision 1954 in the famous Brown versus Board of Education case, which opened up the whole educational world and inaugurated the many improvements in the area of civil rights of the last 20 years. The famous case which struck down the separate but equal school systems of the South. Justice Warren wrote at that time, "It is not unconstitutional to give extra consideration to all who have disadvantageous backgrounds, provided full benefits are applied equally to all who fall into that class. And again, when the state has undertaken to provide an opportunity for an education, it is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms." The very basis of the original 1954 decision was this Equal Protection Clause. To strike out that clause now or to declare it temporarily in abeyance, which is, of course, is impossible legally, would be to destroy one of the safeguards for all groups within the social order. And again, during the De Funès case, one of the fine constitutional lawyers in the United States, who has unfortunately since died, Alexander Bickel, Yale University, wrote this: "For at least a generation, the lesson of the great decisions of this court and the lesson of contemporary history have been the same. Discrimination on the basis of race is illegal, immoral, unconstitutional, inherently wrong, and destructive of democratic society. Now this is to be unlearned, and we are told that this is not a matter of fundamental principle, but only a matter of whose ox is gored. Those for whom racial equality was demanded are now to be more equal than others. Having found support in the Constitution for equality, they now claim support for inequality under the same Constitution." There's a very real problem here. And it's one which cannot be glossed over easily one way or the other. I, for one, have no problem with Judge Battisti's decision here in Cleveland. I have no problem with a process in the social order which would see to it that when racial discrimination has been found within a corporation or within a labor union or within a hiring program or within housing or within any other area of our social order, a court can require a specific racial goal or racial quota as a remedy for that particular ill. The remedy will suit, presumably, the guilt, and will reflect the racial composition or the ethnic composition or the religious composition of the particular community at that moment in time. I have a great deal of problem with the concept of someone trying to manipulate the social order on the basis of some abstract set of racial or minority categories, which include some minorities and exclude others, which have no way really of determining how one fits under one category or under the other, without and simply declaring it to be a matter of necessary policy for America at this time to move ahead in this direction. If we are a society under the Constitution, we must abide by the Constitution. And if it means that other ways, then these racial categories must be found to solve these problems. I'm convinced that there's enough ingenuity in the society to find other ways. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm sure that there are nuances of this case and of the constitutional issues which it raises of which I'm unaware. But I am a rabbi, and I do know that 2,500 years ago, our people rejected the concept of inherited guilt and the corollary concept of inherited privilege. I read to you this morning from the 18th chapter of the prophet Ezekiel. He and his contemporary Jeremiah are interesting in that both of them very strongly affirm this concept of individual responsibility under the law, and they very strongly oppose the older concept which was part of the original conventional wisdom of Israelite society, that as a father sins and his children bear the iniquity unto the second and third generation. And both interestingly do so on the basis of what was obviously a well-known proverb. The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge, which must have been a bit of experiential wisdom, which was obvious in that part of the world. If a man was a spendthrift and he lost what little money, what little land he had to sell himself into bondage. His children grew up as bondsmen, as slaves. Both these prophets use this old proverb, which is popular in Israel, to argue against it. What mean ye that ye use the proverb in the land of Israel, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge? As I live, saith the Lord God, you shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb. Behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the father, so the soul of the son is mine. The soul of the sinner alone shall die. What became the principle of Jewish jurisprudence was this: Ma di'avad avad, that which had been, had been. Once the book was closed on a generation, we cannot go back to it. But there was an urgent demand in this generation, in the here and the now, to do righteousness. Let's forget the past. There's no inherited guilt. There should be no inherited privilege. There is no virtue in vicarious suffering. The issue is, what can be done now and how can it be done in order to secure the revitalization of the social order as a just and open and righteous society? That's the issue. And it's interesting that the law, as it has wrestled with the Bakke case, has in a sense come to the same conclusion. There is nothing legally wrong in setting aside 16 places in this class for the educationally and the economically disadvantaged. What is wrong is when a university arbitrarily decides who is educationally and economically disadvantaged and leaves out others who patently are educationally and economically disadvantaged. That's the problem. And surely if we apply our wisdom and our skill, we can find affirmative action programs which establish categories of those who are educationally and economically disadvantaged and provide for them specific quotas. Social action in this sense is highly to be commended. And because there are so many who are Black and Mexican American and Native American and the like in the category of the educationally and economically disadvantaged, they will be, in that sense, proportionately advantaged by these programs. But what we do then is essentially to say there's need. Let's find a way to take care of the problem. And hopefully when the need ceases to exist, There'll no longer be reason to establish quotas in this purpose. But if once we establish racial quotas or racial goals as the law of the land, declare them to be constitutional, saving a finding of discrimination by a federal court or local court, if we once say that this is one of the ways in which a legislature can tinker with the social order, I'm afraid we're putting ourselves into a position where they will become part of the living fabric of our society, and where up till now we've all been Americans, albeit we have a variety of other identifications and loyalties. From now on, the really essential political issue will be which of the minorities or categories do we fall into? And we'll begin to find Americans claiming, I am not black, I am white, I am white, I am not black, I'm Native American. How are we going to do this process of declaring who is in the category and who is not, unless we go to the Nazi system? So many parts, so many grandparents, and that's certainly not the way Americans want to go. With it all, I speak this with a very heavy heart, because I know that those who live daily as tribunes of the groups which are so disadvantaged have looked upon these affirmative action programs as the most important of the tools at their disposal to achieve opportunity for their people. And I hope and pray that those who speak as I have spoken, out of concern for the constitutional issues, will not stop there. And will not stop once their own rights, the larger rights, as I might say, have been defended, but will remind themselves of the second part to this issue, that the University of California was trying desperately to face up to some real problems, and so must we. And that in our hiring, on whatever committees of admission we sit, insofar as we can help establish the law of the land, we must see to it that programs like the Davis program are established and are administered and are encouraged and are made effective. If we stop at the place where we say affirmative action, as insofar as it establishes racial quotas, is wrong because it is unconstitutional, and are satisfied with that, as I'm afraid all too many are, we will not have addressed ourselves to the problem which forced these programs to our concern in the first place. Nearly half of the black youth of the inner cities is unemployed. And if we cannot reach that problem constitutionally through racial quotas, we certainly have to reach it through employment quotas or in some other way. Amen.